first case for argument this morning is United States against Cephas. Mr. Donovan.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is attorney Chris Donovan. I represent Javon Stewart on this appeal. I'd like to begin with the procedural sentencing argument that we raised in the brief, and then I'll move on to the duplicitous indictment argument. There's really no dispute here that when imposing Mr. Stewart's seven life sentences consecutively that the district court erred. The government basically concedes that in its brief. The real question becomes whether or not this error was harmless and made a difference. And I think that it did make a difference, and this court should reverse and remand for a new sentencing, because I believe that we don't know the impact that not going through the proper analysis had on the district court's procedure. Also, future changes in the law would become important in this instance, whether or not it was consecutive or concurrent, and also any potential pardons that may be granted would also make a big difference in this regard.
I'm a little puzzled. Doesn't the sentence say it's concurrent?
The oral pronouncement from the bench was consecutive.
Yeah, and the written sentence says concurrent. So the only thing that could possibly happen if we remanded on this issue was that the judge would then say, I said consecutive and I mean consecutive, right? And then your client would be worse off. It's not every day that somebody shows up saying, I want a remand that can't possibly make me better off, but could make me worse off.
Well, right now the sentences, I think, are being construed as consecutive, so I don't think he could be worse.
Construed as consecutive. He's already died once, and they're trying to hold him for a second lifetime? How can a sentence that says life concurrent, life X7 concurrent, be construed as consecutive?
I agree right now it probably doesn't make a difference, but like I said, if there's any future change in the law.
What do you mean when you said it is, quote, being construed as consecutive?
Well, I believe that the Bureau of Prisons...
What's the evidence that it's being construed as consecutive? Whatever in the world that could possibly mean.
I would assume that because the judgment...
No. You don't answer a question like that by saying, I assume. You said it is being construed as, presumably by whom, and you have what support for that?
I believe it's the Bureau of Prisons because it's in the written judgment. It's the case that the government cited in their brief.
On what basis?
Past experience. I don't know.
None at all.
I don't know in this case for sure. That's correct. I will move on to the duplicitous indictment issue. This affects all the defendants. A conspiracy charge is a very powerful and pervasive tool that the government uses very often in many cases. I believe that with that power, there's a lot of responsibility. And in this case, the government charged the conspiracy not just in count one, but effectively in every single count in the indictment. And, of course, duplicity is where there's two or more distinct offenses joined in a single count. And the primary problem with this is we don't know whether the jury convicted on one offense or both offenses. The wording that made the indictment duplicitous in this case was the allegations set forth in count one are hereby realleged as if fully set forth herein and incorporated by reference. And I think that the primary danger here was that this made confusing the Pinkerton instruction. Of course, we know through Pinkerton that conspiracy liability can flow from the conspiracy count to each substantive count as long as the substantive count was committed within the scope of the conspiracy, helped to further it, and was foreseeable to the defendant. But the opposite is not true. Liability doesn't flow from substantive count to the conspiracy count, and I believe that the way that this indictment was drafted made that very confusing to the jury. And I don't think that the district court's instructions on this issue cleared it up or corrected this error because it's in tension with the wording of the indictment. The government, in their brief, tries to argue, well, it's really not the full conspiracy count that's incorporated or realleged in full. It's just the factual allegations. But that's not the plain meaning of fully. Fully means entirely and completely. So I think that it's reasonable that when the jury had this indictment back in the jury room and it was sent back with them, and when it's in tension with the instructions given by the court that the jury could have been and most likely was very confused when deciding whether or not he committed the conspiracy and then each substantive count flowed from that or the other way around. And they just decided, well, because the conspiracy is effectively incorporated into each and every count, he must be guilty of every other count. And I think that this is definitely a major flaw in this case. I also would like to just, I guess, spend a few brief minutes on the Eighth Amendment issue that we raised. Graham versus Florida definitely changed the landscape of Eighth Amendment law. Before Graham, there was categorical limits on sentences for certain types of crimes or for certain types of offenders only in death penalty cases. And for the first time, Graham extended that to a non-death penalty situation where it held that for juvenile offenders that don't commit a homicide offense, you can't sentence them to life without parole. I think that there is a lot of reasons to extend that to adult non-homicide offenders, such as the defendants here in this case.
I think this argument is wasted in an appellate court. We can't overrule Harmelin against Michigan, and the Supreme Court has told us that it is the only institution that can say its prior decisions are gone.
I don't want
the justices to overrule Harmelin, you've preserved your position, but they're the only ones who can do it.
I don't believe it would overrule Harmelin, and
certainly it would. Harmelin said there can be life in prison without parole for 650 grams of cocaine. That's inconsistent with the way you read Graham.
I believe it wouldn't overturn Harmelin any more than Graham did. Again, I think based on the factors, the penological factors extended in Graham or laid out in Graham, that they would apply equally to adults as to juveniles. So I don't see any reason why it couldn't be extended. If the panel doesn't have any questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for my co-counsel and also for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you.
Mr. Vogelbaum.
Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. I am Martin Vogelbaum for appellant Justin Cephas, and I want to begin talking about the rather extraordinary use of leading questions in this case, which in our view violated the appellant's rights to confrontation as well as to a fair trial. Conceding at the outset that Rule 611 permits for the use of some leading questions in some circumstances, for example, to develop uncontroversial testimony or to deal with an adverse witness, and conceding even further that generally speaking management of questioning and trial management is a matter within the discretion of the trial court, here we contend that that discretion was abused, because here there were, by my count, at least 60 instances of sustained objections to leading questions. And here they were leading questions of a nature that the trial court clearly recognized implicated important matters in the case, to the point where it gave repeated admonishments to the government lawyer to discontinue the leading on threat of curtailing witness examination or even a mistrial. So I think that what we have here is the rare case in which leading questions really did prejudice the defendants because of the controverted substantive areas into which they led and the evidence or testimony that they ended up eliciting. Specifically, some of the areas that were established by the government here, primarily through the use or largely through the use of leading questions, were, for example, jurisdictional elements with respect to some of the victims. I've cited some instances of that in our brief, and the government has responded by saying, well, even if it's the case that there were leading questions that established the interstate nexus from these witnesses, there was overwhelming other kinds of evidence to establish the interstate nexus. For example, the fact that the defendants advertised this prostitution business in phone books, or that they recruited in a mall in Illinois people who would later work for them in Indiana. And what I would suggest to the court is that although there was other evidence on the interstate elements, it seems to me that the way the jury is likely to be focused on this case and the reason the government pushed so hard to get the jurisdictional element out of the victims themselves is that the jury is thinking about these girls being driven in an interstate way, that is, from Indiana to Illinois or Illinois to Indiana. In short, it seems to me that the government...
But there's no doubt about that, is there? I don't understand what you're arguing.
It's true that there is testimony about that, but a lot of that testimony comes from repeated leading questions by the government from people who evidently didn't necessarily know at the outset, you know, whether a call had taken place in one state or another, or whether something was intrastate as opposed to interstate. And I think that getting the testimony from the victims is the most obviously impactful way that the government could have gone about it. And in that sense, eliciting...
But there wasn't any doubt. Was I don't understand you. What was the doubt about there being... they're crossing the Indiana-Illinois line?
Well, I think they would not, with respect to at least some of these victims, have been able to have established that had they not been permitted to indulge.
Like who?
I'm lacking a name right now. However, I can cite to the portion of the record.
What? I'm sorry, I don't hear you.
I'm lacking a name of a specific victim right now, but I can cite to the portion of the record the transcript at 1835 or 876 or 77, also cited on page 4 of my reply brief. And with respect to particular victims, they may not have been able to establish the jurisdictional nexus absent the leading questions. Further, leading questions were used to establish the force and fraud and coercion element of the offense with respect to the adult victims in a number of instances. For example, the government spent a lot of time leading a witness to say that my client beat somebody with a cord, or establishing that he referred to himself as a pimp, a person who had power in manipulating pussy. And finally, in other instances, leading questions were simply used to inflame the jury or otherwise prejudice my client and the other appellants. For example, the transcript at 865-66, there's a leading question that is designed solely to elicit the alleged fact that my client preferred to recruit white girls for his business in a case with a number of black defendants. The only conceivable purpose of that information, it doesn't prove anything about the charges, is simply to inflame the passions of the jury. And for those reasons, the excessive use of leading questions here prejudiced the appellants, and it requires reversal of their convictions and vacating of their sentences.
Thank you, Mr. Vogelbaum.
Thank you.
Mr. Sandberg.
Good morning, Your Honor. Craig Sandberg for the defendant, Stanton Cephas. May it please the court, counsel. So, before I begin with the argument, I want to make a correction that was excluded from the brief in the sense that exhibits 3C and D, which are the phones that were allegedly recovered by upon Stanton Cephas at the time of the arrest, there is no evidence in the record at all that those are the phones that that were included in Agent Landry's report about what Stanton Cephas's what his statement was to her following the arrest. So I just want to point that out, that there is no tie in the record of those two phones. And I want to address the primary issue here, which is that in this particular case, in hindsight, one would certainly conclude that the allegations that were leveled against Justin Cephas in this, we'll call it a Justin-centered conspiracy, created a stink that could not be washed off of Stanton Cephas, his brother. The evidence in this case is that Stanton would be around his brother. And out of all the girls that testified, nobody tied him to something to suggest that he intended to be part of this Justin-centered conspiracy.
He was just hanging around.
What's that?
He was just hanging around.
It was his brother. The allegations, as far as what his conduct was, is that he dealt drugs to his brother. Obviously, with that, there isn't any indication from that selling drugs to his brother somehow brought him within the umbrella of the conspiracy, because the benefit that the government would have contended is whatever Justin did.
The evidence permit a jury to conclude that he took the girls to their assignations and collected money?
I don't think that that's correct, Your Honor. I think that the evidence in this case would lead a jury to conclude that from time to time he would do things that any family member would do at the request of a brother, not necessarily for the
drive a prostitute to an assignation is one of the things
any family member would do. Eh?
Well, I certainly think that the evidence in this case suggests that there was a level of fear that Stanton had towards his brother, and that's reflected in.
I asked a simple question. Did the evidence permit the jury to find that he drove the girls to assignations and collected the money? The answer is either yes or no. It sounds like you're saying yes, but he had an excuse. He was just a dutiful brother.
No, I don't think that the evidence would allow a jury to conclude that he collected money from.
Why wouldn't the evidence allow the jury to conclude that, since there was testimony that he accompanied the girls to the assignations?
And I would agree that there's evidence that he drove girls to locations, but I don't think one of the things that Your Honor had talked about was whether or not he collected monies and then transferred those monies to his brother. There is no evidence, I don't believe, in this
record.
There are
some possibilities. He collected the money and kept it, or he collected the money and gave it to his brother.
There is no evidence whatsoever that Stanton Cephas benefited in any way from this Justin Center conspiracy regarding the prostitution.
The money to his brother.
What's that?
In that event, he must have given the money to his brother.
The money was never given to Stanton.
The money. So the girls didn't charge for these.
The girls didn't give Stanton Cephas any money. There is no
evidence. The girls didn't give it to him. The Johns gave it to him.
No, the evidence in this case is that the Johns gave the money to the girls, and then the girls then transferred that money to another girl, and then that girl would give money to Justin Cephas. Money never passed through Stan Cephas' hands regarding this Justin-centered conspiracy. The only evidence in this case is that that Stanton would be at his brother's home, that he spent time with his brother, that he sometimes did things for his brother, but not for the purpose of that business operation that he's alleged to have conducted.
I think trying to re-argue the facts to an appellate court is largely a waste of time.
Well, I don't believe I'm trying to re-argue the facts. I'm trying to suggest, as my brief argues, is that the district court failed in its obligation to grant the motion for acquittal and the renewal of that motion for acquittal because there is no evidence, there is not sufficient evidence to allow that case to get to the jury. And in this particular case, there was 10 days of evidence, and my understanding, I couldn't find it specifically in the record, is that the jury was given the case right before lunch. They had lunch, and they came out about 3 hours later.
Why wouldn't just driving these women to their appointments, why wouldn't that be enough to make him a part of the conspiracy?
Well, I don't think, regarding that, I'm not sure that simply driving them
Why not? He knows what's going on. He knows what they are.
I don't think that there's specific evidence that these girls, whenever he would drive them someplace, would say, "Hey, this is what I'm going to do." And so I think that.
Did he think he was doing?
I think he was doing a favor for his brother, and I don't think.
Well, what was the nature of the favor he thought he was doing for his brother?
Well, I don't think that there's any evidence that.
Well, use your imagination.
I don't believe in this particular.
Well, what would be an innocent explanation of what he thought he was doing?
For one of the things, there is the evidence about driving the girls to the truck stop. I don't think that Stan asked what they intended on doing, and I don't think that there was the discussion from the girls to him about
That's ostrich behavior. Why does he think his brother wanted some woman driven to a truck stop?
Well, regarding that truck stop, that was an independent request made from the girls to him, not a request from his brother. So that was.
And what did he think? I don't understand.
Well, and I understand that because he didn't testify, we don't know what he.
First, you say he does these things for his brother. Now you're saying he's just doing it for the women.
No. I apologize if I gave that impression.
Well, that's what you said about the truck stop, that he was called by a woman, not by his brother.
It was one of the girls.
What was the favor he thought he was doing for his brother?
helping give someone a ride to a location that they
and
requested.
Why did he think his brother wanted someone to get a ride to a location?
Well, because Stanton didn't testify in this case. There is no evidence about what he thought was happening. But what we do know...
What he thought was happening? Well, that doesn't help him if he has no defense.
Well, he does have a defense. He wasn't involved in the Justin Center conspiracy that's alleged.
No, that's the issue. No.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. The government in this case properly indicted, tried, convicted, and sentenced each of the defendants, and the judgments against each of them should be affirmed. I would propose to focus primarily on the issues that the defendants have raised here in argument, and to go back through them in reverse order, starting very briefly with Mr. Sandberg's argument regarding Stanton Cephas. The reality is a jury easily could have found sufficient evidence, and I would just ask to point out two specific instances to the court. The defendant contends that he never collected money, and that's simply not true. The most powerful evidence was probably the evidence from his own girlfriend, A.G., who was known as Dago or Thini. That appears primarily at pages 1244 through 1247 of the transcript. And she talks about how they started to hang out at Justin's house, that they discussed whether she should go on calls. She was either 16 or 17 at the time. She was underage, so it was not permissible for her to go. Who drove you to those calls? Stan. Did anyone else go with you? Yes, it was a female. And did you receive money from the calls? You did. And who drove you? Stan did. Was Stan still there after you got done with the call? Yes. Who got the money? Stan did. And then what happened to it? It was given to Justin, and he split it up. With who? Stan. Stan got it because I was there with him. So, I mean, this is the same procedure that happened. Whoever the girl's specific pimp was got half the money, and Justin, the head pimp, got half the money. Or Justin got all the money if he was the only pimp. And the one other place I would point out is a girl named Cherish at pages 1584 through 1585 who testified that in 2006 she went on two calls in Indiana with Stanton. She gave Stanton the money when they were done with the call, and Stanton gave it to Justin. So those are just a couple instances, and there are many more that we've cited, if the court wants to go through the whole record, but that alone is enough. Moving on to Mr. Justin Cephas' primary issue regarding the leading...
Did Stanton know that these women were being intimidated and threatened and so on?
Well, he did, Your Honor. He did. There was testimony that he observed one particularly vicious beating of a prostitute named Shiloh. There was evidence that he also observed a beating of a prostitute named Cassandra and laughed about it with Justin and I believe Javon Stewart, although I'm not exactly sure if Javon was at that instance. Those are cited as well in our brief. So there is evidence. There's no doubt, Your Honors, that Stanton was less involved than Justin, but simply because one is a backup player in a conspiracy doesn't mean that one is not a member of a conspiracy, and that's dealt with through minor player role reductions, through lower sentences, which Stanton did receive here despite his hefty sentence. It is not by any means a life sentence, and that's how that is dealt with. But he was clearly a member of the conspiracy. If there are no more questions about Stanton's role, in terms of the overall use of leading questions in this trial, Rule 611C primarily commits the area of the mode of questioning to the district court. This court reviews for abuse of discretion, but only will reverse if there is evidence of clear prejudice.
Were so many leading questions asked? Were these witnesses reluctant or
I believe a lot of these witnesses were nervous, Your Honor.
Still intimidated?
I think that considering what
or
they went through,
by their
I think,
profession or
what? Well, it wasn't their profession, Your Honor. They were homeless girls who needed a place to stay, and they got themselves involved in this. And while a few of them were already prostitutes, but many of them were not, Your Honor. And they kind of fell into this and thought it might be fun, and then were too intimidated or scared to get out, or they did it. There was the testimony of the one girl who said, "I have two children. My power was shut off," and I was terrified, and I called, and I thought I knew what I was getting into, and it was the 23 worst days of my life before I could get out. They were punched. They were beaten. And it's still intimidating to be standing or sitting this far away from your attacker. The United States concedes that there were leading questions that were used. But the question is whether, and perhaps more than should have been. But this is an area that is committed to the district court. And the district court, Judge Lozano here, when he felt that it was getting out of hand, he stepped in and he stopped it. And when he felt that it was completely getting out of hand, he had a conference with the jury out and said, listen, if this doesn't stop, we're going to consider more extreme measures regarding limiting government examination, and if necessary, even a mistrial. And I'm not going to say that it stopped after that, but it certainly slowed down. And this trial transcript is 2,300 pages. So to point out that there were 60 instances of leading questions in that length of a trial, while a large number, it is certainly not the case that every question that came out of the prosecution's mouth was a leading question and every response was, yeah, yeah, whatever you say. That's not the case at all. Indeed, you know, the defendant wants to point out to, like, page 1835 of the transcript to a witness named Allison and say this is a great example of a leading question. And the government asked a leading question. Essentially, isn't it true that, you know, one of your first two calls, I'm going to get this possibly wrong, but it's on page 40 of the brief. You know, Allison was asked, you know, isn't it true that your first two calls were in Illinois? And she said, no. The government's trying to lead the witnesses to what to say, and she says, no, that's not true. My first calls, you know, were both in Indiana. Later on, I took calls in Illinois, but I remember my first two calls, and they were not. They were in Indiana. So the witnesses were not just being sort of led down the primrose path here. They sometimes needed to be directed in these lengthy discussions to where they needed to go, but they were not led in any kind of prejudicial fashion that prejudiced the defendant's rights. And it has to rise to that level for this court to even say that it would consider a reversal. I'm not sure that I've found any instance in federal reporter law where a court has actually reversed based solely on the leading nature of questions. But in any event, this should not be the first. Returning then back to Mr. Stewart's arguments, Chief Judge Easterbrook, we agree with you that there is no basis for any kind of reversal here of the judgment. The judgment says concurrent, and we believe that's what the district court meant. The district court made a slip of the tongue, as happens to most of us every now and again. But in any event, if the government had wanted to cross appeal and wanted to try to somehow make these consecutive for no particularly good reason, I suppose we could have. But the reality is that the defendant cannot point to anything. We've pointed out this court's acknowledged unpublished decision from Wilkins L., but it basically says what we believe to be the case, which is the Bureau of Prisons gets a judgment from us, from the court, and reads it, and doesn't go back and read the transcripts and say, oh, I think there's an error here. That's, in fact, why it is so critically important that if the judge made an error in the written judgment and makes things worse for the defendant, that we correct those. So as far as future changes of the law go, I don't think that is the basis on plain error review for reversal. Certainly, to the extent that it matters, the government is more than happy to stand up here and waive any entitlement it might have for all time in making any of these sentences, these life sentences consecutive. But the reality is it doesn't make any difference whether life sentences are served concurrently or consecutively in the first place.
It doesn't make any difference unless you're a Buddhist.
That's true, Your Honor. And if there are Buddhists in the BOP that want to try to take advantage of this, I suppose we would have a problem. But since they don't know what's in the judgment anyway, they won't know. In the record, yeah. As far as the duplicitous nature of the indictment, Your Honor, again, I think it's important to note that we are on plain error review. To whatever extent there could be some arguable confusion in exactly what the government was attempting to reallege in the separate counts of the indictment, I think a fair and natural reading, the most natural reading of this at least, is that the government was realleging the allegations, whatever allegations that were in there, and was saying that, for example, count two is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 2423, and so on and so forth in each of the other counts. To the extent that the jury could have been confused, the jury should have looked to its jury instructions, and the jury instructions, which were not objected to, explained to it, these are the conspiracy elements that you find on count one. Count two charges a violation of 18 U.S.C. 2423 for taking a minor across state lines. These are the elements that you have to find it. These are the elements that you have to find for this. The Pinkerton instruction is the boilerplate Pinkerton instruction that this court has approved. It set forth that if you find on the conspiracy, you can but not are not required to find on the substantive counts under certain circumstances. Nothing in it flowed backwards, as the defendant tries to seem to argue and say they could have found on one substantive count and then convicted on everything. There's no basis for that. And certainly on plain error review, if we're even on plain error review, we have pointed out under Rule 12b-3, this Court has sometimes suggested that Rule 12b arguments not raised are waived. If this is even reviewable at all, it certainly is not meritorious. And on the Eighth Amendment issues, Your Honor, again, we believe that if the Supreme Court wishes to extend the rule that life without parole is not permissible for all adult non-homicide offenders, that is a matter that is best left to that court. Nothing in Graham certainly compels such a finding. This argument was not raised at the trial court level and would, again, it seemed to me, be on plain error review. I guess the defendant's argument, I suppose, seems to be that his category of offenders is essentially everybody who didn't commit murder, and I don't think that that's the way that the court has viewed this. The court in Graham seemed to distinguish Harmelin on the fact that there was a specific, unique characteristic to innate characteristic to a class of offenders, namely their youth. Perhaps that might justify extension to, say, the mentally challenged, as the court did for death penalty purposes in Atkins versus Virginia. But I don't think that there's any basis for extending it to essentially everybody except murderers. And so we would urge the court not to do that. Those were the only issues that were raised by the defendants in their oral arguments. I'm happy to address any other issues that were raised in the briefs if the court has any questions on any of them. But to the extent it does not, we would rest on our brief and simply ask that the judgment against each defendant be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Donovan?
Thank you. One brief response to one of the arguments the government raised. I don't think that the duplicitous indictment issue was waived. If anything, it was forfeited. I didn't clarify this in my reply brief as well as I should have, but waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right, and here clearly that none of the defendants intentionally waived their right to challenge the indictment. So I think, if anything, it would be reviewed.
The rule uses waiver in a strange sense, but it does say that any issue that can be raised without trial of the general matter must be raised before trial. This was an issue that could have been, and the rule then says, and if you don't, it's waived. What it probably means is forfeited, or it's just barred. And this was an issue that could have been raised and wasn't. Now, what does one make of that?
Well, that's true. I would urge this court to view it as a forfeiture because, again, it wasn't intentionally waived by any of the defendants. So, therefore, I think it would be plain error review, and that's what I would ask this court to review the issue under. So that's all I have for rebuttal, unless there's any other questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. And the court, Mr. Donovan, Mr. Vogelbaum, Mr. Sandberg, the court thanks all of you for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. Thank you.